to have you on, Rania. Thanks for taking the time.
It's great to be on with you. Thanks for inviting me, Richard.
So Joe Biden is now president. He's been inaugurated. On his first day, he signs a bunch of executive orders, and he rejoins the Paris Climate Accords, the World Health Organization. So he reverses some of Trump's policies. Do you think he could have done more, however, especially for the working class in the United States?
100%. I mean, what he should have done is he should have come into office, and the first thing he should have done was immediately get out relief checks for people. That should have been his first priority. Was right away, and that's, he campaigned on that. A week before he was elected, he was saying, it's on video, get us elected, get the Democrats, get us in the Senate in Georgia, and we're going to get you $2,000 checks. Democrats were campaigning on that issue, and now, you know, we're back to negotiating maybe $1,400, maybe we'll have it by March. And I was expecting this. You know, Biden is your kind of typical centrist right-wing Democrat. He is doing exactly what Democrats do, which is the very, very least. The very, very least they can get away with. And, you know, there's, I mean, there are some, of course, some good things that we should be happy about. Like, of course, he overturned some of Trump's more draconian policies with regard to, for example, the Muslim ban. But, you know, he was also applauded for ending private prisons. Well, he didn't actually end private prisons. He signed an executive order that ended Justice Department contracts with private prisons, but also that's just a reversion to what happened under Obama. So it was just undoing something that Trump had done. You know, I think one of the more alarming aspects of his incoming administration on the domestic front has been really trying to ramp up fear around this new domestic war on terror and trying to get support for the idea of more anti-terrorism legislation, which we don't need in the U.S. I mean, we already have enough laws on the books in the U.S. to put all of us in jail for thinking the wrong things at this point after 20 years of this endless war on terror. The last thing we need is more laws like that. There's already plenty of laws on the books to deal with what we have known for more than a decade now is one of the biggest threats in America, which is the rise of the far-right violence. The U.S. is in an economic crisis right now. People are facing economic ruin. The COVID virus is still completely out of control. And obviously, he's only been in office for like a week or so. But still, I mean, there should be way more measures being taken to try and help people. Or you know what? They're going to have way more riots in the streets, you know, after a few more months or another year of this.
I'm sure you enjoyed the confirmation hearing of Austin Lloyd, who's now the first black Secretary of Defense, or Secretary of State Blinken. What did you make of, of those? Because, you know, in terms of policy, it's not really that diverse. These are the same people who support a regime change and intervention in Syria and Libya, and they're given job promotions and cabinet positions, and they're rewarded for supporting these horrible policies under Obama.
Well, you know, in order to qualify for being a part of the foreign policy establishment in the U.S., you have to support all those wars. I mean, if you watch this confirmation hearing, actually, I know you did because you were commenting on it yourself. I mean, it was just like it wasn't even a question and answer session. It was like an interrogation by the neocons who run foreign policy in Washington, D.C., some of the most belligerent ones. He had to sit there and basically submit to and bow down to the most warmongering stances proposed by Lindsey Graham. And he was happy to because he actually agrees with those people. It's not like he was really pretending. He actually agrees with the things that he said. I mean, he was pro-regime change, pro-recognizing Juan Guaido, pro-sanctions on Venezuela that are killing 40,000 people a year. You know, he was pro-ramping up the Cold War with China. He was, you know, he repeatedly bragged about his support for arming the right-wing neo-Nazis in Ukraine, though that's not how he says it. I mean, the list goes on, one thing after another. And, you know, even on Iran, I will say that's probably the one point of difference between a Biden administration and a Trump administration that's quite drastic is the desire to go back to the Iran nuclear deal, mostly because people like Anthony Blinken were involved with helping negotiate it. So it's like near and dear to their hearts. They have like an emotional attachment to it. But at the same time, when it comes to Iran, even though that's a difference between them, at the same time, the same underlying narrative about Iran remains the same between these two parties. Mike Pompeo and Anthony Blinken are very difficult to tell apart when they're actually talking about Iran because they say the same exact things.
Right. I saw Blinken's first press briefing, and he essentially said that he wants Iran to take the first step towards the JCPOA. I'm confused by that because the United States is the one who left the deal. Shouldn't the U.S. be the first to show some goodwill, some good faith in re-entering the deal first?
Well, that would be logical, right? And that's what's funny is you see these pronouncements coming out of the Biden administration about how, yeah, Iran has to go back to the deal first. And it's like, you're the one who broke the deal. Like, it was you. The Trump administration, okay, not only did they break the deal, they over and over and over repeatedly committed acts of aggression and provocations for war. They killed Iran's top general on foreign soil. That's unprecedented. Like, you don't do that. They broke, I mean, and the U.S. behaved like a rogue state completely. And the sanctions, I mean, if there was, if some more powerful country came along and implemented sanctions on the U.S. the way the U.S. has implemented on Iran, the U.S. would nuke them. Because that's an act of war. Putting a country under economic siege like that is an act of war. So it's completely outrageous for anybody in the Biden administration to think they have the upper hand morally whatsoever, or are in any kind of position to be telling Iran that you're the one who has to make concessions first.
We're seeing that Robert Malley, who's the lead negotiator on the JCPOA, on the Iran nuclear deal, apparently a lot of Zionists and pro-Israel people seem to be against him. I mean, we know from the get-go that Netanyahu and such, they opposed the deal, but they seem to have a particular issue with Malley. Why is that the case?
Because when Robert Malley was inside of the Obama administration, he was a voice of reason when it came to not just Iran, he was a voice of reason when it came to the war in Syria and when it came to Libya. And basically, he was an obstacle to the like neoconservative designs for the Middle East, because not only did he have these viewpoints that he would then in his advisory role to the president, you know, express, but he also acted as somebody who connected the White House to back channels between these countries that the Israelis and the neocons in the U.S. want the U.S. to destroy. So that's why he also plays an important role, because his time working for the International Crisis Group, you know, that's not, it's a you know, non-governmental organization that has those contacts within these different governments the U.S. doesn't talk to, which is why it makes him an important figure like that, you know what I mean? So this is why somebody like Robert Malley, I mean, he can make or break a war if he's able to bring, you know, the right messages and right people to an administration that maybe wants to start one or has some people in it that wants to start one. And he did play that role during the Obama administration. There was, you know, especially after the rise of ISIS in Syria, there was times when Robert Malley was able to connect, you know, to like serve as like this intermediary between these back channels to de-escalate, you know, the tensions between Syria and the U.S., which the U.S. started to change its positions to some degree after the rise of ISIS because they didn't want ISIS taking over the entire region. But, you know, neocons did. So it's also, I think, the, you know, the attacks on Robert Malley are also the Israel lobby and, you know, the neoconservative think tanks. And that kind of segment of the establishment, it's their way of putting a red line. It's like if they fight something as small as just one advisor, you know, it's kind of putting a line in the sand of, okay, then the Biden administration is going to be less likely to cross that later. So it's also just making themselves be heard and just trying to get in the way. You know, they're desperate. They really don't want to return to the Iran nuclear deal. They want a war with Iran. And so this is also their way of trying to make sure that somebody who might be able to stop it isn't there.
In terms of Yemen, the Treasury Department, they issued a license and suspended sanctions for about 1 month. We also saw a last-minute arms sale to the UAE and Saudi Arabia was paused for review. Do you think there's some sort of rift in terms of support for Saudi Arabia, or is this just symbolism, just for show?
So far, I don't see anything beyond symbolism, and it's yet to be seen. Yemen is one place where there may be a change in policy, and I hope there is, because it would definitely prevent a lot of suffering if there were a change in policy in terms of overturning sanctions. As far as the U.S. relationship with the Emiratis and the Saudis, I mean, at the end of the day, it's actually quite normal for an incoming administration to pause any arms agreements after like that were made under a previous administration. That's not abnormal. That's not out of the ordinary. And, you know, the U.S., I don't think the U.S. is going to change its entire relationship with these people in the Middle East. These are its allies. It's not going to change overnight. So I really think it's again, like when it comes to Democrats, you get a lot of symbolism. I do think in the long term, you may see a deterioration in the relationship with the Saudis moving forward, because that's more because the U.S. is shifting away from the Middle East slowly. But it is shifting away from the Middle East being sort of the center of its foreign policy strategy making. The U.S. for the future is much more interested in great power competition with Russia and China, particularly China. You know, something like 2/3 of U.S. naval assets are actually in Asia and surrounding China.
Wow.
So, you know, it's I don't think this is necessarily because a Democrat came into office. I think it has more to do with the fact that liberals, Democrats, they do empire better and they're more effective at it. And this already had started under Obama, and they're just kind of continuing the sort of the trajectory of U.S. foreign policy that existed at the end of the Obama administration that got slightly disrupted by Trump, but not really that much. And part of that is shifting away from the Middle East a little bit.
You know, Biden is continuing Trump's policy stealing the oil in Syria. We're also seeing an uptick of attacks from Daesh, a double suicide bombing in Baghdad, and these bus ambushes in Syria. Do you think this is going to be used as some kind of excuse to keep troop deployments there or increase them maybe?
No, that's a great question. I think, you know, I can't tell the future, but I think what's most likely is that those kinds of things will be used as justifications to keep the remaining troop presence that America has. The troop presence in Syria is accomplishing the goal of making sure that the Syrian government can't access its own oil. And the U.S. presence in Iraq is accomplishing the goal of basically acting as a barrier between Iraq and Syria. That's what that's the whole purpose of that, is to keep these countries from connecting with each other. A continuation of what saw happening under the Obama administration, which was more of a reliance on small special operations units and specialized groups of troops rather than large troop presences as our way of like doing empire now.
In the last month, unfortunately, the rest of the Middle East has continued to see destabilization and unrest. There has been an unusual uptick in attacks by Daesh. In December, we saw a horrific ambush take place in the Syrian desert near Palmyra, where dozens were killed. This was followed by another bus attack in Syria in January. In Baghdad, there was a double suicide bombing, which left over 30 dead and scores of wounded. And the latest in Iraq, 12 fighters from the Hashd al-Sha'bi, or PMF, were killed in another ambush by Daesh. Now, some speculate that the recent rise in attacks by Daesh could be used as another excuse by the United States to maintain its forever presence in the Middle East, occupying Syria's oil and occupying Iraq as a buffer with Iran. In many ways, much remains the same and business as usual. We've seen Israel continue its regular bombing of Syria absolutely unchecked, killing a family of four just the other day. Not a word of condemnation from the international community or the new administration. Within one day of Biden's inauguration, Syria's Sana news agency reported that a U.S. convoy of 40 trucks had entered Syria illegally through the Al Walid border crossing with Iraq. These convoys have been a regular occurrence, as Trump has been busy stealing the oil, which he shamelessly admitted.
We're keeping the oil. We have the oil. The oil is secure. We left troops behind only for the oil.
This was confirmed in late 2020 during a Senate hearing between Senator Lindsey Graham and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that a U.S. corporation, Delta Crescent Energy, would be plundering Syria's oil in a deal with the Kurdish-led SDF. Bashar al-Jafari, Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, sent a clear message to the UN Security Council saying that the new U.S. administration must stop acts of aggression and occupation, plundering the wealth of my country, withdraw its occupying forces from it, and stop supporting separatist militias, illegal entities, and attempts to threaten Syria's sovereignty, unity, and territorial integrity. Now, one area where it looks like there might be some hope, however small, is Yemen. We saw how the Trump administration on its way out designated Yemen's Houthi movement as a foreign terrorist organization, or FTO, slapping Yemen with sanctions. Yemen has been gripped by war, famine, and disease since the Saudi-led coalition began its war against the country in 2015, with support and arms sales from the U.S. and its allies. 80% of Yemenis live in Houthi-controlled areas. Now, the United Nations calls what's happening there the worst humanitarian crisis in the world and says that if these sanctions are not removed immediately, we could see the worst famine in decades. During his presidential campaign, Biden said that he would end U.S. support for the Saudi-led genocide in Yemen. So far, we've seen a few developments in that direction. The State Department under Blinken has launched a review of the former Trump administration's terrorist designation of Yemen's Houthi movement, or Ansar Allah. The Office of Foreign Assets Control under the Treasury Department has issued a temporary license that exempts Ansar Allah from sanctions. However, this license only lasts 1 month until February 26th, 2021. While this seems like a step in the right direction, 1 month might not be enough to convince traders, suppliers, and banks to continue operating in Yemen. More importantly, this doesn't fix the original problem, which is the terrorist designation itself. While, of course, 1 week might seem too early to judge a presidency, let's not forget that Joe Biden and his cabinet have been in government for most of their lives and vehemently supported a lot of these failed policies that caused these problems in the first place. Secretary of State Blinken, Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, Joe Biden himself, these are all people who supported intervention in Syria, Libya, Yemen, Iraq, and have given unconditional support to Israel and Saudi Arabia. We know what their records are, and we know they're cut from the same cloth. Fixing the problems they helped start is the bare minimum. Needless to say, I'd love to be proven wrong and actually see some concrete steps taken in the right direction. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
World Bank estimates that the COVID-19 pandemic will push up to 150 million additional people into extreme poverty by the end of 2021, with food insecurity rampant. The differing performance projections have much to do with the vaccine delivery timetable. Vaccines are expected to be widely available in advanced economies and some emerging markets by the middle of the year, but people in poorer countries will likely be waiting until at least 2022 and beyond. We're prepared for you an article written by Kenneth Rogoff, Professor of Economics and Public Policy at Harvard University. The piece is titled, Uneven Recovery from COVID Recession Could Hit Poorer Countries Hard. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Kenneth Rogoff's article. Economic recovery like COVID-19 vaccines will not be evenly distributed around the world over the coming 2 years. Despite enormous policy support provided by governments and central banks, the economic risks remain profound, and not only to frontier economies facing imminent debt problems and low-income countries experiencing an alarming rise in poverty. With the coronavirus far from tamed, populism rife, global debt at record levels and policy normalization likely to be uneven, the situation remains precarious. This is not to deny the overall good news of the past 12 months. Effective vaccines have become available in record time, far sooner than most experts had originally anticipated. The massive monetary and fiscal response has built a bridge towards a much hoped-for end to the pandemic. And the public has gotten better at living with the virus, with or without the help of the national authorities. But although growth outcomes around the world have been vastly better than most expected in the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, the current recession is still catastrophic. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, forecasts that the United States and Japan will not return to pre-pandemic output levels until the second half of this year. The Eurozone and the United Kingdom, again declining, won't reach that point until well into 2022. The Chinese economy is in a league of its own and is expected to be 10% larger by the end of 2021 compared to the end of 2019. But at the other end of the spectrum, many developing economies and emerging markets could take years to return to their pre-pandemic trajectories. The World Bank estimates that the COVID-19 pandemic will push up to 150 million additional people into extreme poverty by the end of 2021. With food insecurity rampant. The differing performance projections have much to do with the vaccine delivery timetable. Vaccines are expected to be widely available in advanced economies and in some emerging markets by the middle of this year. But people in poorer countries will likely be waiting for the vaccine until at least 2022 and beyond. Another factor is the staggering difference in macroeconomic support between rich and poor countries. In advanced economies, additional government spending and tax cuts during the coronavirus crisis have averaged almost 13% of the gross domestic product, with loans and guarantees amounting to another 12% of gross domestic product GDP. By contrast, government spending increases and tax cuts in emerging economies have totaled about 4% of gross domestic product or GDP, and loans and guarantees another 3%. For low-income countries, the comparable numbers are 1.5% of gross domestic product in direct fiscal support and almost nothing in guarantees. In the run-up to the 2008 financial crisis, emerging economies had relatively strong balance sheets compared with developed countries. But they entered this crisis burdened with far more private and public debt and are thus much more vulnerable. Many would be in deep trouble but for near-zero interest rates in advanced economies. Even so, there has been a growing rash of sovereign defaults, including in Argentina, in Ecuador, and in Lebanon. In fact, a taper tantrum 2.0 is near the top of the list of things that can go wrong. And if or when it happens, not only emerging markets will suffer. The 2013 taper tantrum occurred when the U.S. Federal Reserve started signaling that it would someday normalize its monetary policy, triggering huge outflows of funds from the emerging markets. This time, the U.S. Federal Reserve has taken great pains to signal that it does not plan to raise interest rates for a long time, even introducing a new monetary framework that basically amounts to a promise to keep its foot on the gas until unemployment is extremely low. Such a policy makes perfect sense. As I have frequently argued since 2008, allowing inflation temporarily to rise above the U.S. Federal Reserve 2% target would do far more good than harm in an environment where debt levels are high and output is still below potential. After all, there are 9 million fewer people working in the United States today than compared to a year ago. But if the U.S. has achieved its vaccination targets by this summer, and coronavirus mutations remain contained, forecasts of a U.S. Federal Reserve liftoff from zero interest rates may well be brought forward significantly. This is especially likely given the huge reserve of savings that many Americans have built up, owing partly to rising asset prices and partly to government transfers that many recipients chose to save. ultra-low interest rate policies across the world are helping to prevent long-term scarring, but many larger companies, including big technology firms, do not need the support that is driving their stock prices through the roof. This is inevitably fueling populist anger, a small taste of which was evident in some U.S. politicians' reactions to the recent GameStop stock price war. Inflation may be stubbornly low for now, but a big enough blast of demand could push it higher, leading the U.S. Federal Reserve to raise interest rates somewhat sooner than it now plans. The ripple effects of such a move on asset markets would separate the strong from the weak and hit emerging markets particularly hard. At the same time, policymakers, even in the United States, will eventually have to allow bankruptcies to pick up and restructuring to take place. A rising tide of recovery is inevitable, but it will not lift all boats.
Around the World with Reporters.
There are many EU legislators who depict Russia as a dangerous adversary that needs to be restrained. They condemn the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny and the handling of protests in Russia.
The European Union needs to send a message by not only considering new sanctions, but also by increasing our support to prosecuted, tortured, and repressed voices of the opposition and the civil society.
It's rarely highlighted by mainstream media in the West that Navalny received a prison sentence last month after returning to Russia for breaking the terms of a 2014 suspended prison sentence. Also, Western media never mention the global pandemic when reporting on public protests in Russia organized by Navalny supporters. Just last weekend, 500 protesters were arrested here in Brussels, and those detained made claims of police brutality. Mainstream media vilify demonstrators here and in other Western nations for breaking COVID-19 rules, while at the same time portraying protesters in Russia as heroes. The EU and US accused the Russian government of poisoning Alexei Navalny last August. Navalny was treated in Germany after the alleged murder attempt. The Kremlin denies any role and is clearly unhappy that EU authorities refuse to provide medical evidence.
It is quite impolite, mildly speaking, and it is such arrogance from cultural Europe. It seems to me unacceptable and we categorically reject it.
There are many reasons why Brussels should try to improve relations with Moscow, some EU lawmakers insist.
Well, Russia is a capital neighbor. We cannot ignore that the longest neighbor, the longest border, it is with Russia. Russia is not only, an energy supplier. It's as well a strategic relation.
A good case in point, a number of EU nations are now scrambling to get their hands on Russia's Sputnik V COVID-19 vaccine, which is more than 90% efficacious. The EU has major vaccine supply issues. Moscow says it's happy to help. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
People are marching on the streets to show support to the people of Kashmir. This rally in Islamabad is part of a series of events in Pakistan organized to mark the Kashmir Solidarity Day. Pakistan observes the day every year on the 5th of February. Pakistan's foreign minister led the rally in Islamabad and urged the international community to play a role in ending the suffering of the people of Kashmir.
The purpose of our today's rally is to express solidarity with the people of Kashmir. The people of Kashmir have been under siege for the last 18 months. But we want to make it clear that India cannot suppress the freedom of Kashmir forever.
Kashmir has remained under lockdown since August 5, 2019, when India revoked its special status. Thousands of people have been detained, and over 8 million Kashmiris have little access to the outside world.
We are thankful to the people of Pakistan and the government for supporting us. We are hopeful that Pakistan would continue to support us till Kashmir is liberated from India.
We must understand as the Kashmiris are living under occupation and oppression for the past 73 years. And the 5th of February marks a day where we, the people of Pakistan particularly, tell the Kashmiris living across the line of control that they are not alone. Pakistan and India have competing claims on the long-standing Jammu and Kashmir issue. Both claim the region in full but rule on parts of it. They have fought wars over Kashmir, where tensions continue to increase. There is a fear of yet another conflict on the dispute between the two neighbors. The country's prime minister visited the Pakistani-administered Kashmir to mark the day.
Prime Minister Imran Khan says Pakistan is ready to take two steps forward if India is willing to seek a political settlement of the long-standing Kashmir dispute. However, given the current hostilities between the two neighbors, experts believe there is a slim chance of any dialogue on Kashmir, at least in the near future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Boazir University continue protesting the appointment of AKP-affiliated rector. University academics turned their back to the newly appointed rector's office as a symbol of objection. The academics called for the resignation of Melih Bulu, the rector that was appointed by Turkish president. Protests have been going for weeks now, with police arresting hundreds. Demonstrations broke out early January when Turkish president appointed Melih Bulu, an academic with strong ties with the ruling party, as the new rector for Boğaziçi University. Students and academics complained that the appointment broke a decade-long tradition of Boğaziçi rectors being elected from within the university academic team. The Boğaziçi crisis gathered support from other universities and oppositions, who saw in this new trial from the president to force control over the country after granting himself sweeping powers post-coup attempt in 2016. Erdogan said the protests are not led by students, claiming it is stemmed by opposition parties.
A segment of politics is leading the way for this. It is not possible to describe and accept the protests as incidents about the university students. Turkey's opposition parties, including main opposition, Republican People's Party and E Party, as well as People's Democratic Party, are behind all of this.
Turkish president also slammed the U.S. and France over their reaction to the protest, mentioning the incidents taking place ahead of U.S. elections and calling French President Macron to take care of the Yellow Vest protests in his country before pointing fingers to what is happening in Turkey. Erdogan argued that the law grants the president the authority to appoint rectors and that he had done it before in other universities.
The whole issue broke out after the president appointed the new rector. This is not against the law, but the problem is that Melih Bulu isn't an academic, and this is against the law. I disagree that the protests were driven by political parties. It started by students. Of course, opposition parties are taking advantage of the protests to lash out at the president.
The government response to the protest came harsh, as peaceful protests have been met with overwhelming violence and arrests. Critics and human rights activists say those are efforts by Erdogan to seize more power, using the coup plot as a scarecrow. The Boğaziçi protest brings to mind the huge Gezi Park protest held years ago, with many saying that it will continue because the problem is in the system itself. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Tensions between Beijing and Washington escalated once again, this time after the U.S.-guided missile destroyer USS John McCain sailed through the Taiwan Strait despite repeated objections from China. The transit was the first such move since the inauguration of Joe Biden as U.S. president. The U.S. Navy claimed the move demonstrates Washington's, quote, commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific, saying that the U.S. military would, quote, continue to fly, sail, and operate anywhere international law allows. Beijing, however, considers any passing through the waterway as provocative and a breach of its sovereignty. It says such operations threaten stability in the region and embolden separatists on the self-ruled island. China is also strongly against deepening ties between Washington and Taipei, since it sees Taiwan as part of its territory. A It has repeatedly called on the United States to respect the One China policy and stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. Taiwan, however, views itself an independent territory. The previous U.S. administration under Donald Trump tried to bolster Taiwan's international standing by sending several high-level envoys to the island. It also approved sales of sophisticated weapons to Taipei, including F-16 fighter jets and advanced missiles. The moves drew strong condemnation from China and caused relations between the two countries to sink to the lowest level in decades. With Biden taking the helm at the White House, there was some optimism that Washington-Beijing ties would improve. However, it so appears that there is no end to the downward spiral. Experts believe Biden is also using Taiwan as a playing card against China.
The Biden administration, despite having quite a bit of experience, is treating Taiwan like it's a playing card. Unfortunately for the Chinese side, it's not a playing card, it's a red line. So these are the type of very dangerous situations which can, in fact, lead to an armed conflict.
Taiwan is one of the multiple fronts in the Sino-American standoff. The dueling economic powers have been in loggerheads over a host of issues. The U.S. has recently blacklisted several Chinese officials over a new security law in Hong Kong that Washington claims to be against freedom of speech. China, however, says the law will return stability to the economic hub that has been embroiled in anti-government protests for months. China accuses the U.S. and other Western countries of being behind the protests. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. The two sides are also involved in a bitter trade and cyber wars. During Trump's presidency, the U.S. imposed sweeping tariffs on Chinese imports, prompting tit-for-tat measures from China. Experts believe that there is a bipartisan anti-China sentiment among U.S. politicians.
There's a bipartisan anti-China feeling, not only among the American people, but also in Congress.
The recent moves and statements from the Biden administration suggest that tensions between Beijing and Washington are far from over. Biden's policy on China has so far proven to be different from that of Trump's administration, only in rhetoric, not in kind.
Jobs and working conditions are much more in danger today than in normal times. That's why the main French trade unions call for a nationwide strike and demonstrations in order to defend jobs, salaries, and working conditions. The COVID crisis is leading to an important loss of jobs and to an explosion of poverty. Trade union leaders call for a social spring.
The social spring is a formula we use to say that the social question cannot be denied in this difficult period. So the anger we notice every day in the enterprises should find an expression. We want our demands to be heard.
These workers of the big French multinational Total are threatened with dismissal, despite financial support from the state. Other big companies in France, such as the pharmaceutical Sanofi, car constructors Renault and PSA, and Airbus also benefit from important tax reductions and financial aid from the government. But that does not prevent them to fire workers.
Sanofi receives about 120 million euros every year for research. They pay less taxes and they are going to pay 4 billion euros to their shareholders. Today they announced a record of their profits. Meanwhile, they are firing workers and they did not find a vaccine. There is a problem.
France has not been able to produce its own vaccine, unlike the USA, Russia, China, and even Cuba. A big disappointment for French people. Experts say it's due to the continuous privatization. Scientific research has been sacrificed for short-term profits.
We can't continue with the pharmaceutical industry that's making a huge amount of profits without investing their benefits in research for the general interest. Public research has to be maintained. The fact that Sanofi has not been able to produce a vaccine reveals a real problem in the system.
According to the National Institute for Economic Studies, INSEE, the French gross domestic product, GDP, went down with more than 8% in 2020. Less than expected, but still a record since the Second World War. Unemployment increased with 8%. Nevertheless, the main French companies are making more profits today than before the COVID crisis. Profits for few, sacrifices for many. It's difficult to organize workers during lockdowns and curfews. Fundamental liberties are put in danger with the COVID crisis. A united front, as shown today in France, is one of the means to go forward. Christian Homes, Paris.
Senior leaders of combined opposition parties, including Pakistan People's Party and Muslim League of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, gathered in Islamabad to decide new course of action after opposition's deadline to Prime Minister Imran Khan to resign expired. After hours-long meeting, they announced that people from all over Pakistan would start a mass long march towards the capital Islamabad on March 26 this year to force the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to step down and hold fresh general elections. The opposition blames the military to have rigged general elections in favor of Prime Minister Imran Khan in 2018.
We are struggling to get rid of an illegitimate government which was formed through rigging in general elections. We are trying to restore the sanctity of the public mandate.
A better sense must prevail among the opposition parties. The opposition must understand that their protests would not bring down our government. When we were in the opposition, we held protest rallies in Islamabad for 126 days to bring down the government.
The opposition launched a public mobilization campaign late last year across Pakistan to prepare people for the long march next month, something which government believes received a lackluster response. Prime Minister Imran Khan says that the opposition parties turned against him after he rejected their backdoor request to stop prosecuting top opposition leaders on corruption charges. The opposition's decision to start a mass long march has come after anti-graft watchdog started prosecuting top opposition leaders on money laundering charges. The former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has already been convicted on money laundering charges.
Analysts believe that the opposition parties enjoy little public support after their top leaders were tainted with the corruption charges. However, discontentment prevails among people over unprecedented price hike after Pakistan devalued its currency under IMF pressure, something opposition failed to exploit in its favor. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
February 4th is World Cancer Day, and on this day, thousands of Gazan cancer patients suffer immensely due to the crippling Israeli blockade. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before being able to receive treatment. Gaza hospitals suffer from acute shortage of medicines, especially for cancer patients. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished enclave can be a stressful and unpredictable process, and many apply multiple times before being able to exit.
Israel usually doesn't allow Palestinian patients to travel through the Erez crossing despite having an exit permit. They only need to leave the Gaza Strip to receive required treatments.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment with a 50% deficit rate. Despite the high number of cancer cases in Gaza, the Israeli regime also refuses to allow spare parts for radiation therapy machines to enter Gaza.
Radiation therapy, especially for breast cancer patients, is not available in the Gaza Strip, and patients must go to hospitals in Israel or the occupied West Bank for treatment. Radiation therapy is a hard process and takes a very long time to get an Israeli permit for such procedures. Oftentimes, cancer patients miss their hospital appointments due to delayed exit permits.
There are around 14,000 cancer patients in the Gaza Strip, 47% male and 53% female. Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among females. Cancer patients have also complained of humiliating treatment at the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing.
The process in the Israeli crossing is extremely humiliating because they insist on strip searching you. I was very sick and they kept interrogating me for 3 hours and then they began to strip search me. I told them that I had a mastectomy, but the Israelis did not let me go through until they did a full body search.
Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to further deteriorate. Human rights organizations in the Gaza Strip have repeatedly urged the international community to help bring an end to the Israeli blockade and save the lives of cancer patients. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
According
According to the International Organization for Migration, at least 600 families were forcibly displaced from their homes in Yemen in January due to the increasing confrontations in several governorates of the country.
The areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition suffer from instability, insecurity, and the spread of armed groups. Therefore, the residents of these areas are leaving to save their lives from missiles, projectiles, and armed confrontations. These have all been confirmed by the international organizations, including IOM.
The IOM says Al-Hudaydah, Al-Dale, and Taiz governorates have the highest number of displaced people. As the war continues in these areas, most displacements occurred during the last week of January, indicating that 2021 may witness more of this crisis.
The issue of displacement can only be solved by lifting the imposed siege. Those displaced greatly suffer from the absence of support from international organizations. These people must be among the priorities of the humanitarian operations. It is shameful to see an increase in the number of displaced people in 2021 due to the continuing armed conflicts.
Millions of families had to leave their homes for survival since the beginning of the war in Yemen in 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on the Arab country, killing thousands of civilians, including women and the children. 2021 doesn't seem to be better than the previous years for Yemenis, as the war continues to create new difficulties for thousands of people who had to migrate for their lives. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled that it is willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal from which former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally exited in 2018 and reimposed anti-Tehran sanctions. But 2 weeks after taking the helm at the White House, Washington's return to the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, still hangs in the balance. The U.S. says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord, but Tehran says it was Washington that walked away and hence it should fulfill all its obligations, which include the lifting of all sanctions. Amid the standoff, Iran's foreign minister warned that the Biden administration has a limited window of opportunity to re-enter the agreement. He, meanwhile, suggested the question over who must take the first step in returning to the JCPOA could be resolved by EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell.
He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are needed to be taken by the United States and the actions that are needed to be taken by Iran.
In reaction, the European Union said it is working extremely hard to salvage the deal and is in talks with the U.S. administration to see if sanctions could be lifted. And this is how the U.S. reacted to Zarif's suggestion.
If Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same. And then we would then use that as a platform to build a longer and a stronger agreement that also addresses other areas of concern.
Such a stance was earlier echoed by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, which is in line with Washington's policy to expand the JCPOA beyond Iran's nuclear issue. French President Emmanuel Macron has also said Saudi Arabia should be involved in any new negotiations with Iran about the deal. But Iran's president has reiterated that the JCPOA remains unchanged.
I clearly tell the global community, and especially the countries in the JCPOA, whether it's 4+1 or maybe 5+1 in the future, that no clause of the JCPOA will change. Know this, and no one will be added to it.
After the U.S. pullout of the JCPOA in May 2018, Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, the EU, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Iran says its measures are fully reversible upon the full compliance by the remaining signatories. Presently, questions arise as whether the Biden administration will follow the path of its predecessor against Iran or will try to rectify the Trump-era policy, which has been described as a failed approach even by some of Washington's close allies.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The capacities of the country are much more than the ones stated in our documents, writings, and speeches. Every corner of the country, including your Azerbaijan and Tabriz, this was correctly mentioned by the Honorable Friday Prayer Leader, is a sea of various economic, scientific, social, artistic, and other such capacities. Every place in the country is a sea of capacity. This year's 10-day Fajr ceremonies and this 22nd of Behman are different, because after years of selfless efforts, the people see today that the echoes of their yell, their oppressed and powerful yell, can be heard clearly in other parts of the world of Islam. What I will say about a revolution, about the great event caused by the Iranian nation, which holds lessons for us, is primarily a picture of the realities of the world, so that we can see what the arrogant powers, the colonialists, the global bullies, and the hegemonic powers wanted and what really happened, so that we can see what they were looking for and what happened in reality. Then, I will point out two characteristics of our revolution which are related to our times. Regarding the first part, which is about presenting a picture of the current situation and comparing it to what the global bullies were looking for, I would like to say that the victors of the First and Second World Wars, mainly consisting of a few European countries and America, had a predetermined policy for the important Middle East region. This was because the Middle East is important in terms of its geopolitical position as a region that connects Asia, Europe and Africa together. It is also important in that its oil fields are among the biggest sources of oil in the world. Oil is vital for all industrial powers that have dominated the world. Moreover, in terms of its population, the Middle East region is home to ancient and deep-rooted nations. Therefore, they adopted a certain policy for this region.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. And the first part saw how Lorna Tychosiuk made her first trip to Iraq just before the start of the war to reveal the humanity of Iraq's citizens through her photojournalism. Consequently, her attempt to enlighten the American public turned to controversy as Fox News broadcasters called her efforts, quote, villainous and even bordering on treason, and accused her of aiding and abetting the enemy on the brink of war. But Lorna was never intimidated by such words. Instead, she continued her efforts to report stories that go beyond mainstream media coverage, and during her trips to Iraq, she endeavors to get as close to the people as possible and find her way to the ordinary people in the streets of Iraq. Well, stay with us for the second part of our documentary.
It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and we were just...
You said you knew where they were, near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and north, east, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
We flew back, and we spent 6 weeks living in an unprotected hotel, talking to as many Iraqis as possible, traveling in taxi cabs and in people's cars, people who started to befriend us after a while. This particular camp kind of adopted me because I would keep going back. A lot of journalists go to Iraq, they get the sexy story, they go home, they write about it, they never go back. These people, I usually go visit everyone. I try and visit everyone I've spoken to, like, you know, different people who I've had conversations with on each trip to see how they're doing, get a recap. They invited me to their eldest son's wedding, and this was wild. I mean, we had... My interpreter and I and the videographer arrived at this squad camp.